Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In just one moment, I believe the best guest to have on the air this particular day, the author of Rocket Men, the epic story of the first men on the moon. It's a marvelous book. Our guest has looked at 23,000 of pages of NASA's writings about this event. The 400,000 people who helped put men on the moon, and what we learned from putting people on the moon. We'll be talking about all of that. But I know that many of you listening to us right now were probably not alive 40 years ago, or you were very, very young and didn't fully remember that day. In 1961, John Kennedy said, "I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth." In 1969, on this day, this is what happened.
Steam forward. Altitude, velocity, light. 8.5 down. 220 feet. 15 forward. 11 forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet. 4.5 down, 5.5 down. Within 60 feet, 6.5 down, 5.5 down. 9 forward. Good. Within 20 feet. 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward. 5%. How many feet? 875 feet. That is looking good. Down a half. 6 forward.
60 seconds.
Lights on. 6. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. 30 feet down, 2.5, picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down, straight shadow. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little. 1.5.
30 seconds.
Forward, contact light. Okay, engine stop. ACA at a descent. Hose control, both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
After I'm on, take care of the defense. I'll get the stuff prepared.
Most of the voice you heard was of Charlie Duke, capsule communicator for Mission Control. And that's what happened 40 years ago. That's the way it was. 40 years ago. Today, actually, and we're talking with the man who's written the definitive book about the preparations in the years that it took for this event to happen, the personalities involved, and really what we learned as a result of going to the moon. Craig Nelson is our guest. He is the author of Rocket Men, which has received absolutely fabulous reviews, the epic story of the first men on the moon. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Craig, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, Craig. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Kathleen, I want to tell you my parents are from Black River Falls in Toma, Wisconsin. So when they asked me if I would do Wisconsin Public Radio with you, you bet it's number one on my list, I said. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, yeah. Our pleasure. Actually, the only other person in the world I would rather talk to or have as a second guest this hour with you would be Walter Cronkite.
Yes, I know, of course. In fact, one of my favorite stories about that whole thing is that during that landing, which was unbelievably hair-raising, we at home didn't really know what was going on because there were so many terrible things happening. Mission Control could barely explain it to themselves, much less the rest of the world. But Walter Cronkite did. So with all of that coverage you're seeing of him sweating and barely able to get right. out the words, he knew how close that was to being a disaster. And you can see that in his face of that great newsman.
Yes. Isn't it interesting to hear the voice, though? They have this pilot voice, this sense of control, this everything is okay, and yet this comment, we were turning blue here, we can breathe now.
Yes, well, what you're actually hearing in that tape before that happens is Buzz Aldrin reading out dials and gauges on his side of the lunar lander. They're both standing up, by the way. The lunar lander was flown with both men standing and velcroed to the floor, like almost like a space trolley. Anyway, all that you're hearing from that is Buzz Aldrin reading out his gauges and dials while another man is announcing how much time they have left according to his fuel calculations. And during this whole landing process, you're not hearing a word from Neil Armstrong until he finally says, Houston, Tranquility Base, the Eagle has landed.
And tell me about this fuel thing. This is one of the things you discovered in your book, that they had seconds left to make this landing.
Oh, I spend so many pages doing this landing because it is literally one of the most hair-raising moments in aviation history when you add up everything. First of all, NASA had planned for the entire landing to be done by computer with no human contact at all. Only there a number of things went wrong. The first was that there was a tiny puff of air when the two ships, Columbia and Eagle, separated, and they hadn't taken that into account. And when you're in space, in zero G, that tiny puff of air will send you awfully far. So it was like a champagne cork popping when the two ships separated.
Oh, my God.
Secondly, we didn't know that the moon has very strange properties in gravity because there are enormous chunks of it that are much heavier than the rest of it. They're called mass cons or mass concentrations. So its gravity is not something that's easily computed. Third, the Eagle had two kinds of radar, landing radar and a radar for reuniting with the mothership. And because they were set up differently, the two radars started conflicting with each other, and this overloaded the computer, which sent out screaming, clanging alarms and flashing lights saying it was overloaded and need to restart it all the way to the surface of the moon.
Woo!
Then, mission control on the ground lost radio contact with Eagle, and they had to reroute the symbol through Columbia with Mike Collins in orbit. So they had a three-second delay with all of this, meaning every single thing they were getting was constantly behind. And finally, Neil Armstrong tilted the ship forward. It lands on its tail using a rocket, sort of like a helicopter in a way, and you tilt it forward to look out the window and see what you're doing. And so Armstrong tilts out the window and sees that the computer is about to bring them down in a bunch of boulders.
Right.
And so he takes manual control of the ship, but he can't figure out where he is or where he should go because all of the charts and maps and pictures that they have of the surface are from 4 miles behind him.
Oh, my
Between
gosh.
All of these conditions, they're now four miles beyond where they were supposed to land. So as he's trying to land by hand, manually, he starts running out of gas. And one of my favorite discoveries, in fact, is while everyone at Mission Control is losing their minds, that's what he's referring to, turning blue, they're watching the gas gauge collapse as Armstrong is still not set Eagle down. One guy there had run tests back on Long Island with the lunar module, and he had seen that if too much propellant were in the tanks, the blowback from the rocket would make the ship explode. So while everyone else is terrified they're running out of gas, he's terrified they don't run out of gas.
Oh, my goodness.
What a story.
What a story is right. There's so much in their heart rates. You have these details that are just so engrossing. Their heart rates, they seem very calm, but you know what their heart rates were.
Yes, absolutely, because they were wearing these telemetry devices that measured their pulse. Armstrong's heart rate was so explosive massive. It's amazing, you know, he didn't drop dead. It's way up there. But the whole time, he's Mr. Cool Stone is another, right. Oh, as Charlie Duke, that Capcom referred to, gave him the nickname of Mr. Cool Stone. And boy, was he ever.
Yeah. And Aldrin was, tell me about the personalities here, because they're fascinating. Aldrin had real problems after he got home. And was it really because he was second on the moon and not first on the moon? What difference does it make?
Well, let me back up.
All right.
The first thing is the fact that, like, I think most Americans, I had the opinion of astronauts as being these wild daredevil cowboys from the Tom Wolfe model.
Yeah.
And in fact, I found out that they're exactly the opposite of that. The signature quality of every astronaut during this period in time is that they come out of military test flight. And what they do in military test flight is sit there on the radio and read what all the dials and gauges are saying, just like Aldrin was doing in that landing, back to their radio controllers on the ground who are engineers compiling data to make the planes better the next go-round. But the perfect military test pilot is the guy who does this while his plane is screaming out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of this wild daredevil, you know, testosterone thing image that you have, what really unites the astronauts as people is that they're very cool characters under tremendous pressure. And in fact, it is so different to fly a spaceship in no atmosphere using a rocket than it is to do a jet or an airplane, that you can actually say their piloting experience isn't that important. It's the fact that they have this tremendous cool under tremendous pressure that's what unites them. However, once you get beyond that, they have almost nothing in common. And we have this monolithic idea that all these astronauts were all, you know, the seven astronauts were all one unified, cohesive group. They were so different from each other that it's that they successfully worked together as a triumph,
yeah.
You know. So when we get to the individuals here, I've got to tell you one story.
Yeah, you'll tell us many stories.
Neil Armstrong, while working for NASA, almost got himself killed three times.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about really tight situations. And this was actually one of the eye-opening things for me, was how dangerous and risky all of this was, not just the missions themselves, which were terribly dangerous, but even the training was very risky. And the most famous moment when Armstrong almost died is he was practicing landing on the moon in a vehicle called the Lunar Lander Training Vehicle, which looks like a big old-fashioned iron bed, except that it's got a rocket motor underneath it. So you're propelling yourself in the air with a rocket below your seat. And then you sat on it. They didn't stand, but you sat on it and you used controllers similar to the ones you would use in the lunar modules of the Apollo program. And you would elevate this thing to a certain level, and then the rocket would throttle to imitate the 1/6 gravity of the moon. However, unlike the moon, the Earth has wind, and wind shear on his 21st flight in this device, wind shear toppled the thing sideways, and all of a sudden it started falling. And Armstrong bailed out with 2/5 of a second to spare.
Oh, my gosh.
The machine the vehicle exploded in a fireball. He took off his flight suit and went back to work.
Oh.
And everyone at NASA is running around. They've heard someone almost died in this test, but they can't figure out who it is because Armstrong's sitting there like nothing happened.
Nothing happened. He doesn't say anything.
He didn't even report it at the astronaut meeting that week. And finally, they realized who it was, and they came up to us and said, oh, tell us what happened. What was it like when you almost died? And he said, well, you know, it's always a sad day when you lose a machine. So there you are.
And there was some competition. He evidently pulled rank, didn't he, to become the guy to take the first step on the moon rather than Aldrin.
Well, this is a fascinating story, and there are many answers to it. And one of the great joys in doing this book, besides, you know, it took 400,000 Americans to get to the moon, and they came from all walks of life. People say, oh, what does the space program have to do with my personal life? Well, in fact, when we have manned space program, it is as much a manufacturing concern as a car factory, and it requires electricians and plumbers and welders and seamstresses and, you know, the whole panoply of American trained jobs. It creates this massive job outpouring. But anyway, besides learning all of the stories of these people and taking you behind the scenes and showing you what it was like for ordinary men and women to be involved in this incredible mission, I just loved hearing all of the technology stories, you know. Like, for example, right before Kennedy made his announcement, NASA decided they were going to test pigs in outer space, because pigs have so much anatomical similarities to human beings. So they made a special cradle for the pig, and they put one of the pigs in it, and they strapped it in, and it almost immediately dropped dead. And so a young secretary who was working there came over and said, you know, I grew up on a farm, and you can't put a pig on its back because the stomach fat will suffocate it. And that's what happened. So they had to switch from pigs to monkeys.
Oh, I never knew that.
Isn't that
incredible? Fascinating?
And 8 years later, those people sent men to the moon.
Oh, my gosh.
That's the pace of technology we're talking about.
Well, let's talk about Kennedy's vision here, because you say some interesting things. That he wasn't entirely – we have this idea. Kennedy wanted us to go there. He was this young, vital president. We all agreed, yes, this is the final frontier, the next frontier. We will do this. But he had – he was talking about, well, isn't there something significant we could do on Earth?
Yes. It's fascinating to me to find out the number of times that, you know, we've used his two big speeches on going to the moon, and everyone is now watching them on TV over and over again for the anniversary. But what's fascinating is to me is I was able to find at least four times when Kennedy reached out to Khrushchev to try and talk him into ending the space race and going to the moon together. And Khrushchev would not do this because he was using his triumphs in outer space to imply that he had as sophisticated and powerful a military as he did cosmonauts in orbit, none of which was true. The Soviet Union did not have decent reentry technology. They could not get their warheads to their American targets at this time, and they did not have big, strong enough missiles to work as ICBMs. This is the origin of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that they didn't have strong enough rockets to do what they thought, what they were implying they could do. Anyway, so Kennedy tried again and again to end the space race, but died before that could happen. And the real engine in going to the moon was Lyndon Johnson. Johnson was the head of the Senate when NASA was formed under Eisenhower. He was probably the signature element in Kennedy's speech in going to the moon. And after Kennedy's death, many people tried to talk him out of it, saying, you know, we can save so much money if we don't get to the moon by 1970. And Johnson said, no, he owed it to Kennedy to do it.
Hmm. And is that what he meant, or did he want to achieve this thinking that this would be a big thing to have accomplished during his administration?
Both. Lyndon Johnson wanted to be a president who carried forward the Franklin Roosevelt new society. He called it New Deal, Roosevelt called it. So he was going to be he wanted to be the sequel to Franklin Roosevelt. But many of the things Kennedy was doing in civil rights and with the space program were part of that as well. So so he had two feelings. And one thing I wish people would remember is Lyndon Johnson was a very complicated character.
Yeah, he was.
Very complicated.
Right.
You know, on the one hand, he was sort of this cracker kind of guy. And on the other, he was one of the most progressive presidents in American history. And I'm awfully glad we have Medicare.
Well, there you are, you Texas guy. There's your next book, right?
Yeah, I love Johnson, I have to say.
Yeah.
But I like paradoxes. I love von Braun. I love those intense paradoxes. But you had asked me before, and I'm so sorry. I got so excited talking about pigs in space. I didn't answer the question. You had asked me before about picking the first man on the moon. And one of the great joys in researching this book was going through all of the different memoirs and interviews with all everyone involved in those big decisions and finding out the 17 answers to that question, all right? In the first place, even though it seems odd, NASA has an enormous background with the Navy. It was actually its predecessor, the NACA, was founded under Franklin Roosevelt when he was Secretary of the Navy, because Congress wouldn't agree to pay for it, and they snuck the budget into the Navy's budget, and he agreed to do it. But also, that agency helped the Navy learn how to land aircraft on aircraft carriers during the 20s and 30s when they were being developed. And so, and of course, many, many Navy men became part of NASA history. Neil Armstrong, obviously, but also both Kennedy and Johnson. So it's a very strong Navy background. And in the Navy, when you land on unknown territory, the commander does not step out first. The underling steps out first.
Oh.
So in the original press reports, Aldrin was going to be first on the moon, and these were all reports based on testimony from NASA executives. But NASA people were offended that, they thought Aldrin was a little obnoxious in how hard he pushed his career. And in fact, he turned off so many of them, to use a nice 1969 phrase, he turned off so many of them that he was originally not scheduled to fly Gemini, which means that he wouldn't have been on Apollo. The only way he got on a Gemini flight was because the next-door neighbor astronaut who was supposed to do it died in a plane crash.
Oh, my.
So he was constantly sort of aggressively pushing his career, and the NASA executives didn't care for that, and they loved that Neil Armstrong reminded them of Charles Lindbergh. So whether today this was still a good idea for a way to pick the first man on the moon, you can discuss. I'll pass on that
it's
for
a
now.
Great
so,
story.
Then in the run-up to Apollo 11, Apollos 9 and 10, it turns out that the hatch for the lunar lander is next to where the commander is standing instead of where the underling is standing, and the ship is so tiny that maneuvering around in your spacesuits to get the other one out first was difficult. Hmm. So that's the official explanation, that Armstrong was picked because he stood by the door.
Hmm.
But, in fact, I have a number of people I spoke to or read interviews with, including Mike Collins, who believed at the time that Armstrong made the decision he would be first since he was the mission commander.
Hmm.
So you have three different answers to that question.
And then it took a long time for them to get out because the space was so tiny. I got to take a break here, too. I'm so absorbed in the show. They had these incredible outfits on, and what did you describe it about the size of a little tiny tent when you were a Cub Scout trying to put these big things on to take the first step on the moon? Everybody was wondering, come on, let's do it. Get out there. Let's see you walk.
Yeah, yeah. They're in this tiny little ship. And basically, those space suits really are spaceships. They are designed to maintain pressure inside, just like the Michelin Man, the big tire guy. That's what's the inside of those suits, because in a vacuum, you know, your bodily fluids will begin to boil in a matter of seconds. So they had to maintain pressurization, and then they had to wear air-conditioned long johns, because the sweating doesn't work, and it's 300 degrees. So they created these air-conditioned long johns with tiny tubes of cool water to cool them off. And then they had to be protected from solar radiation and micrometeorites, which are little tiny things the size of a little girl's little finger that strike at 17,000 miles an hour.
Oh, my.
So they're wearing this, you know, cross between a suit of armor and a matador suit, but it's really a spaceship in and of itself, a little house. And then they're maneuvering around inside the tiny, tiny lunar lander, and they break off of some of the buttons, which is going to be a terrible thing to happen when we come back from your break.
Hey, oh, you're good. We'll take phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. The author, I mean, he speaks as well as the book is written, doesn't he? He's great. Rocket Man, the epic story of the first men on the moon, just been published by Viking, just came out a couple weeks ago. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Nelson, our guest. The book is Rocket Man, the epic story of the first men on the moon. We'll have him continue the story. He he left us with bated breath waiting for the finish of that story and then go to phone calls. Please continue, Mr. Nelson.
All right. Well, while they were putting up, first of all, it took many hours for them to get out of the lunar lander, partly because they had a biological filter to make sure that they didn't contaminate the moon.
Yes,
and this
yes.
filter got clogged up, and it took hours and hours for it to finish filtering the air. And then the cabin wouldn't fully decompress, which means they couldn't open the door. So they kept waiting and waiting for it to decompress so they could open the door. Then when they got out, they realized that if they closed the door, there was only a little latch on the outside, like you have on a screen door in the Wisconsin Dells. It didn't have a handle that if the door sealed up and the cabin recompressed, there was no handle to open it back up. So they had to leave the door open the whole time. When it turned out that Mr. Armstrong set in that hair-raising landing, set Eagle down so gently that its shock absorbers didn't deploy, and the bottom of the ladder was 3.5 feet from the lunar surface. So I don't think people realized this at the time, but what he did was he climbed down the ladder, and he stepped on one of the foot pads of Eagle, and then he made sure he could get back up on the ladder so he could go home.
Right.
And then he went back to the foot pad and stepped on the moon surface and said one small step.
Let's go to some phone calls. Joyce from Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead, Joyce.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, Joyce.
Okay, yeah. We have very fond memories in our family about the moon landing. We had a baby born the week of the liftoff. And I was lucky enough to get home from the hospital, and we fed him in the middle of the night looking out our living room window looking at the moon.
Aww.
At the very same time, this amazing feat was going on. So there isn't a family gathering or a gathering at a birthday time for this little boy. He's now 40 years old. That he doesn't say, "Hey, Mom and Dad, what were you doing when they landed on the moon?" And to the amazement of all the guests, that's a pretty special story. And it's one that we all hold dear to our hearts the rest of our lives.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
I'm so glad you shared that with us. A man I met yesterday took his first steps as Neil Armstrong took his first steps on the moon. And I thought, oh, my God, my eyes just fill with tears when I hear these wonderful stories.
Yes, thank you so much. And please, I just found so compelling the chapters that look at not only what happened to them, they kind of broke with this, you know, just the numbers, ma'am, just the facts here, because there you are on the moon, and these guys became just children again in some ways, and their descriptions of what they were seeing, I think, are beautiful. Yet they were worried about what they were going to say when they got there, but in the book, they talk so much about what the moon looked like and the horizon and the Earth and how they could get rid of the Earth with their thumbnail. And it was quite extraordinary, wasn't it, Craig?
Well, thank you so much for saying that. In fact, individual astronauts don't say hardly anything. We have that big description in the book because I read all of their memoirs and all of their mission reports and all of these other interviews to put
right.
that together. But yes, absolutely. When you hear what it's like to be on the moon, you can't wait to go. The first thing is that it's 1/6 gravity, so you weigh 1/6 of what you do on Earth, but you got all your muscles. So if you fall down, you can do practically a one-finger push-up to get back up.
Wouldn't
you know,
that be fun?
A jump in the air, your feet, you probably could jump 10 feet in the air. You know, it's like being Superman, or excuse me, Wonder Woman.
Right.
Secondly, there are basically two suns when you're there, because the Earth is 8 times as bright on the moon as the brightest moon you've ever seen at night. You know, take the most beautiful full moon you've ever seen at night, multiply that times 8, and that's what the Earth is like from the moon. So there's that remarkable blue light coming down because it's so much of it is water vapor and clouds and ocean. And then you've got a very intense yellow sun coming down as well because there's no atmosphere to absorb anything along the way. The heat is unbelievable. It's 300 degrees on the moon, but the sky is black as velvet. Because it's so bright, you can't see any stars, but the sky has this unbelievably rich, deep black color. Then, because there's no atmosphere. You can see with perfect clarity for hundreds of miles. It's as though when you're in a beautiful spring day out in the Wisconsin woods and you're standing up high and looking over the rolling hills, and there's just been an incredible thunderstorm and the air is perfectly clear and you have that beautiful clarity. That's what it's always like on the moon. And finally, first I should say that the top layer of the moon is like talcum powder. And when you walk, the dust rises in sort of perfect geometric formation and falls back down because there's no air to disturb it rising and falling. So each puff as you walk is like this perfect little thing hopping up and down. And then finally, it's so small that you can tell from the curve of the horizon that you're on a globe. You can actually see the curvature of the moon everywhere you look. It just sounds fantastic. And then all of the surface is black, white, and shades of gray. And someone said, one of the astronauts said, I never knew how many grays there are until I went to the moon. And another said, being on the moon is to rediscover childhood.
Mm. Yeah. I feel like that's what's happening to me this hour. Let's go to James from Mount Horeb. Hi, James. James,
that was good. That was an absolutely perfect transition for what I wanted to say. And that's that I'm 20 years old, so the moon landing was a literal lifetime away for me and kind of people from my age group, obviously. I just wanted to talk about how wonderful it is to hear about moon landing, get more stories than I had ever heard before, even with Wikipedia and all that good stuff out there. And say that really hoping that sometime within my lifetime and other lifetimes of those of us who have grown up kind of learning Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Mike Collins' names, there's some amount of hope that we might be able to visit the moon sometime within our lifetimes.
Hmm. Craig.
Well, I actually think that, one of the very sad misreadings of history that many Americans do is they say, oh, since we're not doing something like Apollo now, NASA's really gone downhill, and America's really gone downhill. But Apollo was a Cold War battlefield. It was a rush to get to the moon and a crash course and a huge amounts of money spent in order to be able to beat the Soviet Union. And now that the Cold War is over, we aren't doing that just as we aren't having fleets of helicopters in Vietnam. But I also want to say that I believe we will have that competition coming again at some point. I don't know when. I don't know where it's going to come from. I don't know if it'll be political from Russia or China or India, all of whom have very dramatic space programs. Or it could be commercial. It could be space tourism. It could be a mining that's discovered. It could be a new energy source that's discovered. But I'm convinced that at some point we're going to have that explosive competition happening again, and we'll be back and on our way back to the moon and on our way to Mars.
And Buzz Aldrin was saying yesterday, right, at the White House or wherever he was speaking, it's time to go to Mars.
Yes, well, he Von Braun, the inventor of the Masterpiece rocket and ex-war criminal who took us to the moon.
Yes. It's another story,
his whole idea was to get to Mars. That's all he wanted to do. And in fact, many people, that's their great dream in life. And frankly, sooner or later, our sun is going to blow up and we're going to need to find another place to live anyway. And it looks like those places aren't nearby. So sooner rather than later, we need to start looking and getting out there and figuring out what we're going to do when that happens.
Well, maybe that'll be time to call it quits. You don't think so?
No, I hope not.
Yeah, I know. What was it? I never thought there was enough explanation, and there still isn't. I love talking to people from NASA and love the whole space program, and maybe probably in part because of Walter Cronkite. But all the things that were brought back from the moon, I mean, the stories that you've told us that I've really never heard before, the things that we learned from bringing those back and how they were brought back and how we couldn't contaminate the Earth and we couldn't contaminate the moon and how we forever thought of Earth perhaps as a different, fragile kind of place as a result of seeing it the way they saw the Earth from the moon. I think that all of that, NASA maybe needs people to explain that better or people like you to explain that.
Absolutely. One of the things that I've really nag, one of my few complaints about NASA, and I love the agency so much, I really fell in love with them more and more the more I worked on this book. Their history department was so fantastic to work with. I was just on a panel at NASA headquarters with fellow historians, and we had a fantastic time. It was just great. But one of my few criticisms of them is that they were founded as a global public relations effort, and they really need to have a global public relations operation going. Congress needs to give them enough money to be able to explain to ordinary Americans that the space program is a vital part of our heritage and our culture. Not only is it a fantastic economic stimulus, the Apollo program created 400,000 jobs, and it was as much a manufacturing operation as a car factory. It wasn't just engineers and scientists. It was welders and electricians and plumbers and seamstresses and everyone else, every other skilled labor you can possibly think of.
The LOLs, right?
Exactly.
I love that story.
Exactly.
Little old ladies.
They use little old ladies to glue together the spacesuits. But also, it brought tech jobs to all of the Gulf Coast. It saved the aerospace industry when that business was collapsing. We would have had to pay for that through the Pentagon if we hadn't paid for it through NASA. It launched a technological revolution. The whole reason, with BlackBerries and iPhones, we walk around with a very nice computer in our pocket is because of NASA. But also, it revolutionized medical technology like MRIs.
Mm.
And anyway, the list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But it also did fundamental discoveries in science. And one of the things that really amazed me is that I had no idea that we now have an entirely new theory on the birth of the moon based on what was brought back from Apollo. And I don't know anyone else except the most intense NASA historians who know this. Mm-hmm. So coming back from Apollo, they took those moon samples and they analyzed the ratios of the isotopes. And they realized that it matched the isotopes on Earth. And they have a whole new theory that's very accepted now. It's not controversial at all, that billions of years ago, when the Earth was a giant ball of lava, of molten rock, something the size of Mars smashed into it. And the debris created by this accident was captured in part by the Earth's gravity, and it formed into a ring, and then it coalesced into the moon. So the moon came out of the Earth, and we know all that now because of information brought back from Apollo.
Oh, that's fascinating, isn't it?
It's incredible to me, and who knows this? Nobody.
Right.
So let's start with that, NASA PR. Come on.
We're welcoming more phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of Rocket Man is our guest. Let's go back to phone calls. Peter is next from Stoughton. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi.
Speaking of tech jobs, my father worked for Corning Glass at the time, and the company as a whole was kind of responsible for a lot of the glass technology that made the space program possible. And at the time of the moon landing, he and my mother were doing an extended tour of Japan, and they were traveling with Japanese people who knew them, and these people relayed to others that this American that they're with helped make the moon landing possible. And so they were, as a consequence, almost treated as heroes by the Japanese. They were given free meals, free lodging. It was as if my parents had walked on the moon and not the astronauts.
Gosh, my eyes just get wet when I hear these stories. They just drive me crazy. I just love them so much. I'm so glad you called and told us that.
Yes, thank you so much for your call. Joe is next from Fox Point. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. What a great show. Thank you. I was one of those 400,000 who worked on the space program as a new engineer coming out of school in 1968. I went to work for Hamilton Standard in Windsor Locks, Connecticut, and they built the backpack, the Apollo astronauts used.
The very heavy
backpack. Excuse me, that backpack was their survival mechanism that did everything on the spacesuit without which nothing would have happened. So let me make sure you get the credit you deserve, sir.
Well, the company specialized in aircraft cabin control systems. So, excuse me, it was right up their alley, technically speaking. I was just going to comment, during the period, the 4 days, 3 days when the astronauts were driving to the moon, if I can say that, a team of four of us were actually driving from Windsor Locks to Houston. And we got there just a half a day or so before the lunar landing, and what a tremendous festivities took place on that day, I can't tell you. And finally, if I can say this, I had the privilege to shake the hand of Rusty Schweikert, who was an astronaut from the Apollo 9 and did some of the initial test flights for the lunar module.
And a wonderful man. Let's not forget that.
Tremendous guy, redhead.
Right. Yeah. Now, were you the one who pushed the piano in the swimming pool in Houston?
No, that was somebody else.
Oh, all right. Because you sound like someone who would have done something like that. I just want to make sure.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks
so much. The celebrations were something, weren't they? Tell us about the other thing that's amazing. We have all these potential catastrophes, and the error is 1%, I believe. But there are all these components of 1%.
0.1%.
0.1%.
Yeah. NASA had a reliability factor, and I explained how they came up with this number of 99.9%. And if they had gone, 99.99%, it probably would have cost three times as much to do the space program as it did. However, the rocket was so complicated that the Saturn V and Eagle and Columbia that went to the moon, 4,000 parts could have failed under that reliability quotient. But practically none of them did, which shows you the quality of American manufacturing in that era.
Right. It is when you, and I wish I had known this, more of this, when I was looking at that. They didn't even let us know on that day, I think, all that went into this. It is absolutely incredible that we did this, isn't it? We did
this. More you know about the technology and the more you know, I mean, really, I'm sure everyone has heard this already, but, not an Apple or a BlackBerry phone, but the ordinary nothing phone that you get for free or that they pay you to take to sign up for wireless is far more powerful than the computers they went to the moon. So think about using your phone to go to the moon. See what
really?
It was like.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And another really beautiful thing is when you go to the next time any of you go to the Air and Space Museum in D.C. and you can see Columbia and you can see so much of the equipment there, all of the souvenirs, rest in peace there. But anyway, look closely at Columbia because you cannot believe how much of it is handmade. There are huge cables of wires and they're tied together with pieces of twine and perfect square knots. And then you look at the instrument panel, and a lot of it isn't printed. It's hand-painted. It's just unbelievable.
Isn't that something?
It's like the Amish went to the moon.
Oh, you're so good. And tell us your story. You were a scout, right?
Oh, yes. I had a fantastic time. I was an Eagle Scout at the National Jamboree in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And we were tying many knots because that's what scouts do is tie knots. Anyway, and Neil Armstrong said hello to us on his way to the moon because he, too, is an Eagle Scout, as are, I think, 10 of the 12 who walked on the moon. And so there are 30,000 of us there, and we all screamed back. And we were able to watch the touchdown on a giant screen in an amphitheater. So I'll remember that for the rest of my life. But also, I grew up in Houston, and the house I grew up in was the subject of an astronaut scandal.
Oh, yeah, tell us that.
The original seven Mercury astronauts were invited by my neighborhood developer to pretend to buy some of the houses and then flip them and make a big profit. So he was going to announce that the astronauts were moving to this place not that close to NASA and then get everyone to buy. And then, of course, they would never actually live there. And this went to Kennedy, who said, well, you can have your Life magazine exclusive contracts, but you don't get to flip houses in Sharpstown. And I grew up in one of those houses.
Oh, that's such a story, Craig. There's so much to talk about. Let's take another phone call. Bob from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hello, and thank you so much for this fantastic program. I'm in my mid-40s, and one of my very, very first memories as a child is staying up to an incredibly late hour with my dad and watching the moon landing. And then on the 20th anniversary, having the good fortune of being in Washington, D.C., and actually I'm driving to the airport today heading to Washington, D.C. But what I did want to say is two things about the Air and Space Museum, one of which is just the feeling of being there and touching a piece of moon rock that was brought back by the program. And the second thing, and I'm sure the author has seen this, is looking at the moon suit that was produced by the Soviet Union for their planned moon landings. And you can look inside it, you see that the frame is made of wood. And it for me, that was kind of an epiphany in terms of thinking about the technology that went into it and the difference in technological prowess between the Soviet Union and the United States at the time. And I don't know if that's completely accurate, but that's certainly the feeling that I received in looking at that. And again, thank you for such a wonderful program.
Thank you so much. You know, I did an appearance last weekend at Air and Space, and they put my table next to the Columbia capsule and under the Spirit of St. Louis, and I could have just fainted dead there and then. It was so incredible.
Oh, I imagine. We need to talk about the return trip for a while, because that's the most dangerous part of the whole thing. Seems dangerous to me, but that's really the most dangerous part of the journey, isn't it, Craig?
Well, actually, it had a remarkably terrifying comic moment. The first comic moment happened when Mr. Aldrin in his giant suit, in that little spacesuit, which I promised we would reveal after the break, bumped into one of the buttons and tore it off. And it turned out that this was the button that you needed to push to get the rocket to fire to go back to Columbia and go home. And he had to use the cap from a felt-tip pen to push the button, and that worked. Then when they reunited with Columbia, the two different computers on the two different ships started working at cross purposes, and they started yanking each other back and forth, and they couldn't dock. So finally, one of them had to turn theirs off and do it manually, and that worked. But then when you come home from space, we have this incredibly protective atmosphere on Earth, and that's why you don't see people dropping dead all the time from being hit by little meteorites or dying of cancer from solar radiation flares, is because of this incredible atmosphere. But that means when you come home from space, you have to do all these things to come through the atmosphere and not die. You have to hit it at exactly the right angle. You have to have a big fat butt on your spacecraft to slow yourself down. And you have to have this fantastic heat shield that's made out of a compound of resins. And what it does is it burns up and then melts away into char, and it takes the heat with it. And there's this fantastic sort of aurora borealis light show that happens out the window, because you're going so fast the air is ionized. But one of my favorite things in learning about all of this was the fact that nobody at Mission Control got to celebrate until they saw their astronauts on the aircraft carrier, because from then on it was the Navy's responsibility to take care of them, and that's when everyone at NASA could say mission accomplished. And on this day they did it by posting two beautiful things on the TV screens. One had Kennedy saying we want to put a man on the moon in this decade, and the other saying mission accomplished.
Oh my, it makes you cry.
Yes, it's so great.
Buck from Madison. Hi, Buck.
Hey, I would like to give praise to Chuck Yeager. Can we slip him in here?
Of course.
Despite what you say about Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff, there's good things in there. And one of them is Chuck Yeager, right? Bursting the speed of sound, pushing all the aircraft and his own body to do the best, and one of his planes blows up, so he ejects. And he sinks down into the desert in the Southwest, and he's badly burned. Nonetheless, he is standing there at attention when people show up in a Jeep, and in Tom Wolfe's phrase, he had an appointment, he was on time, and they were late. Isn't that neat?
Yes, it is. Craig?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Oh, thanks very much for the call. Do you think that these guys were happy once they got home? Or you asked the question, we only have 30 seconds left. After you've done the moon.
It's a very sad story.
What do you do? It is sad.
The happiest one was Mike Collins, who didn't go to the moon. He had a lovely career with the State Department, and then he became the first head of the Air and Space Museum and really made that museum the powerhouse it is today. So he had a great life. Mr. Armstrong said he was satisfied with the way things worked out, but he was only 38 when he went to the moon. He really had half of his life ahead of him, and he was a pilot first and foremost. When you read his memoir and when you read his comments about his biography, you see that his happiest time in life was not being an astronaut. It was doing test flight back with the Chuck Yeager era, as our caller yes. just mentioned, out at Edwards Air Force Base in that Right Stuff environment in the desert and flying the X-15, which is what Armstrong specialized yeah. in. That was the happiest moment in his life. But after Apollo 11, no one would hire him to be a pilot because if Neil Armstrong died flying for you, you would be dead.
Oh, my gosh. We're out of time.
Oh, gosh.
I wish you'd come back sometime. You're just marvelous.
Anytime.
You're just marvelous. Okay. We'll finish the story. We'll talk more about the story later. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Craig Nelson, what a wonderful guest, isn't he? The book is Rocket Men, the epic story of the first men on the moon, just been published in the last couple of weeks by Viking as we mark the 40th anniversary of the landing on the moon, the walk on the moon 40 years ago today. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the program, Rachel Biblow for on-air production. Until tomorrow.